The Biz News Power Hour.
Well, here we are on Thursday, the 2nd of December, this being the Power Hour that we come to you from Mondays to Thursdays. It's our last one of the week. And would you believe a week ago, we didn't even know Omicron existed. I've had a little chat about that with our partners in Namibia. So coming up on the program a little later is that discussion that Gary Strubel from Nova FM in Namibia and I have every week looking back at the big stories of the week. But on Biz News itself, Jared Neves looks at our best read, best watched and best listened to content once a week. Jared, what's topping the pops on Biz News for the past 7 days?
Thanks, Alec. So on our website, the most popular post over the week, penned by Ivo Vechter, surrounds the controversial seismic survey that has placed Shell in the headlines. Vechter remarks that a panicked petition signed by outraged activists at this late stage is entirely pointless, but it doesn't surprise me. What does surprise me is that the media so uncritically supports these activists against legitimate industry when their claims are so obviously ignorant, false, or wildly exaggerated, and so easily debunked. I should say that readers need to visit our website to read several takes on the topic, some for and some against.
He's certainly not one for the understatement, Mr. Vechter, is he?
No, he doesn't mince his words.
Okay, and what are they watching?
So on YouTube, the interview with David Williams about the state of PRASA and SA's railway network seems to have struck a chord, racking up over 5,200 views. In the 20-minute interview, Williams discusses the critical state PRASA finds itself in and what he reckons the government should do to revive the public entity.
I did do a follow-up on that today after Josie Matthews, the chief executive who was suspended and on gardening leave, was dismissed, fired. Matthews is going to go to court on it. He's briefed senior counsel, and David Williams gave us some insights on that. And I'd just like to point people as well to an absolutely superb video that we have on Biz News TV on YouTube, which is 72 hours of anarchy. It was a presentation at the second Biz News investment conference by Jason McCormick, whose shopping centers accounted for 1/8 of all the shopping centers in the country that were decimated by, decimated is a bad word because that means 1/10, but they were destroyed in the looting of July. So it's been a massive production that Nadia has put together. It's taken her forever, but my goodness, is it worth it. So go on to Biz News TV on YouTube and go and watch that 72 hours of anarchy. I think you'll find it very sobering and very insightful on what actually happened during that period in July. Jared, what about podcasts?
On Biz News Radio, on Spotify, the most popular podcast was an interview with Pete Viljoen of Counterpoint Asset Management. And together with Justin Joe Roberts, Viljoen discusses furniture retailer Lewis Group and investment holding company Savvest. And he touches on Mr. Price as well.
Well, Justin, you've got a follow-up on that one too. This being Thursday, Pete Viljoen's in the show tonight. What do you guys talk about?
Of course, great to have Pete on a Thursday. We chat a variety of very interesting developments happening across the financial markets, focusing on the JSE, and I also get to share shootout opinions for 2022. One is Sasol, one of the big names on the JSE that's done so fantastically well since the pandemic, and the other one is an embroiled real estate company, Rebosis. Very interesting picks, and you'll hear why during the interview.
Look forward to that indeed. BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. Okay, Jared, have you got the news headlines for us today or what? I hope you got something good in the news. It's been pretty depressing up to for most of this week. Maybe there's a little glimmer of hope somewhere.
Afraid to, I'm going to have to disappoint you there, Alec. Yesterday, BizNews reported the Bolito Rage Festival had been cancelled owing to a total of 36 positive COVID-19 cases. Organizers of the Plate Rage have said the festival will continue despite the risk associated with this decision. According to officials for the event, the festival has passed the point of no return, with 900 people expected to attend. Organizers have said only vaccinated partygoers will be permitted to enter. The Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa has terminated the employment of Group CEO Zulani Matthews. The former chief executive was placed on suspension in November, with an investigation carried out in relation to his employment contract. Part of this was to distinguish whether Matthews had deliberately failed to disclose information of his dual citizenship. Prasa learnt of his UK citizenship after the State Security Department rejected Matthews' top secret security clearance. The state-owned entity will begin with a recruitment process for a replacement CEO. Head of the Western Cape Health Department, Dr. Keith Klutter, has said the province has officially entered a COVID-19 resurgence following increased infections. Klutter remarked that the week-on-week percentage change in the 7-day moving average of new cases has been more than 20% for more than a week. And petrol prices reached a record high this week, with some South Africans paying 20 rand a litre to fuel their vehicles. Despite the ongoing financial challenges facing ordinary citizens, Minister Gwede Mantashe has said that if e-tolls are abandoned, fuel prices will most likely increase even further to cover the costs.
Justin, what's in the financial headlines?
The JSE All Share Index is slightly lower at 71,000. In the currency markets, the rand is largely flat against all the major currencies to 15 rand 86 cents to the dollar, 21 rand 12 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 97 cents to the euro. Gold is lower, trading at $1,779 an ounce. Kruger rand will cost you around 29,500 rand. Brent crude is steady at $69.30 a barrel. And the premier cryptocurrency Bitcoin will put you back 900,000 rand.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Today is Thursday, December 2nd, and this is your FT News Briefing. The Women's Tennis Association has suspended its tournaments in China. Some hedge funds are having to go to extreme measures to recruit top traders. In France, wind energy has been swept into a national political debate. And a severe water shortage sparked weeks of protests in Iran.
Water has surely become a hydropolitical crisis in Iran. And it's probably the biggest challenge that the Islamic Republic is going to face in the not too distant future.
I'm Joanna Gao, in for Mark Filipino. And here's the news you need. The Women's Tennis Association says it will suspend its tournaments in China because of Beijing's handling of tennis player Peng Shuai. Last month, the Chinese tennis star accused a former top Communist Party official of sexual assault. Since then, her Weibo account has been censored and her whereabouts were unknown for several weeks. Yesterday, Steve Simon, the head of the U.S.-based WTA, said he hasn't received satisfactory assurances that Peng is free, safe, and not subject to censorship. The organization holds 10 global tournaments in China. It also has a contract to host its marquee finals in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen. The WTA executive said he's concerned about the risks that his players and staff could face if his organization were to hold events in China in 2022. Hedge funds have made out well during the pandemic. So well that in one especially cutthroat corner of the industry, multi-manager funds, there's a war for talent. Firms are pulling out all the stops to recruit top traders, and traders have become pretty bold. Here's the FT's hedge fund correspondent, Lawrence Fletcher.
So I'd heard this instance where a firm had approached a trader. They wanted to hire them. The trader said, okay, if you want to hire me, it's 10 million that you'll need to cough up. the firm said, well, is there any negotiation in that? And they were told, no negotiation.
So, Lawrence, how did the war for talent at these hedge funds get so brutal?
What's really changed is that these funds have done so well during the pandemic, essentially. And they've done really well because, A, they're diversified into lots of different strategies and assets. That's been very good when markets have been choppy. And also they're very good at risk management as well, which basically means that when markets fall very quickly, they're very good at cutting risk. And when markets are, you know, rebounding, they're very good at sort of increasing risk again. So basically these funds have, you know, swollen in assets, you know, by 100 billion in the course of 2 years. So they just need more traders basically to run all this money.
That's Lawrence Fletcher. He covers hedge funds for the FT. In northern France, locals have been protesting against a multi-billion euro offshore wind energy project. It's not the first time there have been protests against wind farms, but this one's collided with national elections. Here's the FT's Sarah White.
This one has sparked particularly strong protests locally. So you've had, you know, fishermen going out in their boats at sea when underwater drilling started this year and sort of sending a flotilla out. So it's been quite a colourful protest that's attracted some attention. But I think it's not so much this wind farm in particular, it's more that politicians have jumped on it because wind farms more generally have become quite symbolic in France. And particularly on the right, on the far right and in the Conservative Party, wind farms have become more and more sort of ideological target in the sense that, you know, people are assimilating this with the destruction of the countryside, of French landscapes. And so that has made it suddenly this incredibly, you know, vocal talking point in France.
But Sarah, in the broader discussion of clean energy, how much does France need wind energy? I mean, the country is known for having a very large nuclear energy industry. Does that play into this debate?
I mean, that's a huge part of the debate. The French nuclear industry has been a source of great national pride for many years. It's the source of many jobs in France. So it has a lot of backers. I mean, that includes the government. And that includes in particular parties on the right, on the left and among green parties, it has some detractors. You know, there's worries about an over-reliance on nuclear as a safe source of energy. But certainly there's a very sort of strong pro-nuclear lobby and in France, and that plays into the debate on wind. There's a feeling among manufacturers and developers of wind projects that the anti-feeling in France partly comes from that, from, you know, a sort of strong pro-nuclear lobby group that doesn't necessarily want this rivalry from other sources of energy. But what all analysts and government institutions will tell you is that without developing and massively ramping up sources of renewable energy in France, and that's not just wind, that's solar as well, France is never going to reach its midterm and long-term energy transition targets.
Sarah White is the FT's Paris correspondent. In Iran, there have been big protests in the southern city of Isfahan. Hundreds of farmers and other residents camped out, basically occupying the parched riverbed of the city's main waterway.
They wanted water. They were vowing not to leave until water was back into the river, which was an impossible demand.
The FT's Tehran correspondent, Najmeh Bazorgmer, has been monitoring the protests. She says they started peacefully.
And then security forces intervened and cleared the riverbed. And then there were clashes at midnight. But Isfahan residents, who thousands of whom had joined farmers the week before, went back to the riverbed and staged a major protest. They chanted anti-regime slogans and the riot police used tear gas and shotguns to disperse the crowd. Many were injured. I've not heard of any deaths, but tens apparently were arrested.
And this water crisis isn't just a problem for Isfahan. Najmeh says the country has faced water shortages for thousands of years.
But in recent decades, the problem has become severe. The population has more than doubled. Iran is struggling with drought for the past two decades. Meanwhile, there has been state mismanagement by which populist politicians have capitalized on votes of farmers and rural people and allowed them to overuse underground water resources. Farmers plant water-intensive crops and nobody in the government stops them.
And even if the government did try to deal with the shortage in Isfahan's Zayandeh Rud River or anywhere else, Najmeh says they wouldn't have many options.
To be honest, there is not much the government can do at this stage because there is no water behind dams. Zayandeh Rud Dam is 86% empty. It's almost empty. So water cannot be given to farmers. On the other hand, the government is struggling with the U.S. sanctions and the shrinking income. So it's not even easy to pay farmers to go and sit home until, I don't know, if in spring there is rain, if there is more water later. So it's a very complicated situation for the government that it can neither give farmers water nor much money to compensate for their losses.
Najmeh told me that sanctions make it hard for Iran to even consider options like new irrigation technology. But the international community does need to pay attention.
Yes, I think this crisis, this water crisis in Iran definitely needs international help. This is gonna be the biggest crisis. And one environmental activist rightly told me that if that happens, it's not gonna be only Iran's problem. Iran has a population of 85 million people. If there is no water, where are they going to go? They have to migrate from the country. This is gonna turn into a global problem.
Najmeh Bezorgmer is the FT's correspondent in Tehran. You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
No one just makes a meal for a special occasion. You may go online or to that really fancy deli on the corner and look at all the different options available in one place.
Maybe I'll make a risotto and I'll make it really special with some truffles, extra parmesan, and chili oil on the side.
So why should investing be any different? Glacier by Sunlamp's investment platform offers you the widest choice of local and global funds from different fund managers that you can mix and match all in one place. And it lets you customize your investment exactly the way you want it, so you can enjoy your life exactly the way you want to. Ask your financial advisor why you're not with Glacier. Glacier Financial Solutions and Sanlam Life Insurance are licensed financial services providers.
Time now to look outside of our borders a little bit as we go to the BizNews wrap of the week. Joining me as always to talk about what's happening on the BizNews website, Alec Hogg, founder of BizNews. Alec, yeah, we were talking before we went live now and you're a little bit over this whole COVID thing.
I'm feeling quite strong about this because I had an interview this week with Adrian Gore and asking him why he's supporting mandatory vaccines. Now, I think you can be a pro-vaxxer, as I am. I've had COVID. I've been vaccinated twice, or both the jabs. You can be pro-vaccines, but not forcing other people to have it as well, because Namibians, South Africans, anyone from Southern Africa, if you tell them to do something, they say no. We get cut for. We don't like it. We don't like being told what to do. And it was a very, very interesting interview with Adrian, which is one of the best listened to, watched, and read pieces on BizNews this week, where he says ordinarily he would never suggest this, but we don't have time. And with a fourth wave, with Omicron now just spreading so rapidly here in Gauteng, where I live in Johannesburg, every second person, it seems, has got COVID now. And the fourth wave is very, very much amongst us. And I just wonder about those people who don't take the protection that they could have taken. To me, it's a little bit like if you go and you're promiscuous and you have unprotected sex, well, the chances are that you might end up with HIV AIDS. if you don't have a vaccine, the chances are you could get COVID really seriously. So it's rational, but to force someone to do it, Adrian's argument is we don't have time. There's going to be something like an extra 35,000 people dying in this wave if they don't get vaccinated. So it's a frustrating situation that we're in, but I just wish more people would be a bit more sensible about this debate and stop arguing against it just because we're being told to do things.
Well, it is, of course, a debate. And as you say, there's multiple facets to the debate. And one of them is around making a mandatory vaccination order. And you have a story on there as well about Saka Liga in South Africa presenting the case against this. What is the nub of their case to not have mandatory vaccination?
Well, where Adrian Gore on the one side is talking about lives, and you can imagine from Discovery's perspective, they are by far the biggest medical aid in South Africa. They don't want people to go to hospital and certainly don't want them to die. Saka Liga, on the other hand, are talking about business interruption. And their view is that if you allow the state to start prescribing on something like this, it's the beginning, it's the start of a slippery slope. So they are worried that the reaction or mandatory vaccines is an overkill. And as a consequence of doing this, the state can start prescribing a heck of a lot more and, getting onto that slippery slope, according to the Saka Liga guys, is a step too far. So that's where they're fighting from. All of this, of course, would be completely academic if people understood the benefits of getting vaccinated and didn't have to be told to do it. And Saka Liga are saying the same thing. Both Piet le Roux and Russell Lamberti, who I had it's a fascinating interview with them as well. They both said, they're pro-vaccines, go and get vaccinated, especially if you are in a vulnerable group, because that's the most obvious way of protecting yourself. But they also say the state shouldn't come in and force people to have it, because who knows what comes next?
Well, what comes next, and a particularly icy patch on that slippery slope, is the expropriation bill. And there's a story on the site about how that continues to creep forward. We interestingly had here in Namibia this week a bill tabled over the weekend and that was withdrawn on Tuesday, that effectively would have concentrated all power in the business sector with the Minister of Trade. You wouldn't have been able to buy, sell, or reinvest in your business without his permission. And in South Africa, we see the expropriation bill creeping forward as well. And these are all infringements, of course, on fairly inalienable rights in the Constitution. What's your reading on this? Is this just one of those things that just edges until someday it happens? Or are there political games being played here?
You know, Gary, I'm reminded here of the South African Constitution's, how it was written for President Nelson Mandela. And then along came Jacob Zuma. And a similar thing with the expropriation bill. It's the guys who started off with it came with the best intentions. I'm not talking about Malema because it was a political weapon for him, but certainly within the ANC, it was with the right intentions. Let's try and free up the land and get it more productively used. But of course, that's for a certain circumstance that they see in their eyes. And you've got to write the law almost like when you go into a prenup for the divorce, the worst possible scenario. And the worst possible scenario in South Africa with an expropriation legislation that is being proposed and Malema, someone like that in power, it'll just become complete chaos. You'll be off to a Venezuela-type, Cuba-type situation in double-quick time. So Terence Corrigan, who wrote that piece for the Institute for Race Relations that we republished, has got a very strong point. He's been banging on this drum for a long time. And quite often the problem with us as a species is that we tend to be pretty focused on one issue at a time, and our peripheral vision is not that great. And this is one of those things in the peripheral vision of 95% of the population. If it is allowed to continue unchecked, then it's not going to be peripheral anymore. It's going to be front and center, and you're going to have an impact from the foreign, potential foreign investors who've already said, we're not putting money into South Africa because you guys are talking about actually having in the law the right to expropriate the assets that I invest in.
And linking to that story that was published about a week ago on the site, but I see it's still getting good traction. And it says South Africa might just survive the ANC. Right. A significant section of the ANC support base vote for it, not so much out of personal loyalty, but because it's seen as the party in power. We're seeing that being eroded. What is the story there? How does South Africa survive the ANC? And is it not almost a race to the bottom to gain as much control before you lose it that in fact destroys us?
Well, it does appear as though South Africa is in the process of surviving the ANC. Within the ANC itself, there's no doubt now that the party itself is rotten to the core. But the good news about all of this is that the ANC has dropped below 50%, an unthought of possibility just even 5 years ago. And it's now well below 50% in the local election results. Another interview that I had that was really interesting in this past week was with Jacques Celier from the Institute for Security Studies, who was looking, he's a scenario planner, a futurist. He was looking ahead to the national election in 2.5 years' time. And his view there is that the ANC will have to go into a coalition with another party, presumably the Democratic Alliance, but potentially someone like Action SA. Although Action SA said they don't ever want to work with the ANC, but they will have to do that to retain power. And he's of the opinion that Cyril Ramaphosa has got the ability to do that. But in 2029, according to Yaki, the whole scenario will be very different. And at that point in time, we'll know whether or not the country has survived the ANC. Of course, the country will survive the ANC. Of course. Countries don't just end, and the problem I suppose you have is how deep into the hole do you have to go before you start pulling yourself out. In apartheid, we went very, very deeply into the hole. Some people say we've probably gone even more deeply through the state capture and the plunder and the suffering that the country's had over the past, particularly past 10 years. But we will survive, and if it's not us, it'll be our children and our grandchildren who I still firmly believe that this is an amazing place with incredible people. Bobby Godsell, actually the former CEO of Anglo Gold Ashanti, put it so well when he said that South Africa is a country that has always been blessed by its people but cursed by its governors.
How does business empower our nation? By bringing produce to our tables, giving us technology that connects us, hospitals that care for us, and the tools that shape our cities. And by backing the next generation of business owners. That's why South Africa banks on business. Business banks on us. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized financial services and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
I'm Justin Roberts of BizNews, and with me for today's Market Insights is Counterpoint's Pete Fullion. Pete, let's start off with the unemployment data released earlier this week. A further 660,000 jobs lost in a single quarter, expanded unemployment rate to 47% and youth unemployment of 77%. How can any economy hope to be successful when half of the country's available workforce can't find jobs?
No, it can't. And I think the joblessness rate or the unemployment rate is a signal that the current economic policies, or not the current policies, the policies that have been in place for the past 20 years have failed completely and utterly. So I think it's a sign of that. And one can't be successful with that level of unemployment.
Pete, and what's even more scary is the rate of deterioration. It was dire, and more than 500,000 jobs were lost in a single quarter. But how does this impact your investment thesis, especially South African-based companies that earn majority of their earnings in South Africa over the next 10 years? If our unemployment is going this rate this quickly, are there any signposts of reprieve for the labor force?
Well, the first signpost of reprieve was that the ANC did really poorly in the last municipal elections. So to the extent that their policies inflict this level of unemployment on the population and the population then start voting against them, that is a positive sign. So that's, you know, but that's the grasping of straws right now. At the moment, the environment is not conducive for business to employ people. It's not conducive for business to invest capital. And therefore, it's not conducive to growth. Fortunately, from an investor's point of view, share prices by and large discount that this continues into perpetuity. And I think there's a non-negligible chance that it doesn't continue into perpetuity. And on that basis, there are still some investments that have high enough prospective returns to justify allocating capital to local South African investors, investments. Having said that, and I think I've said this before, I think it would be very unwise to have all your money in this market by itself, because the environment is risky. The political environment is, there's an incapable state in charge. They can't execute on any of the policies, and the policies are dumb in any case. So it's an untenable situation. So I don't think one should have all your eggs in this basket. But because prices are so low, it warrants at least some eggs in the basket.
Pete, if there are no reforms that you're so desperately calling for, will we be seeing much of the same into the future? Is reforms a necessity to get this country's economy and our employment rate back on track?
Yes, we desperately need reforms. We need reforms of labor legislation. We need reforms of rules and regulations that impact the ability of businesses to allocate capital, to do business, to engage with customers, to make it easier and quicker, and that'll create growth and that'll create employment. But if that doesn't happen, then I think you can extrapolate the current trend into the indefinite future.
Pete, on the business front, Impala's second attempt to take over at Royal Bafokeng, they just announced this morning that they've acquired more of the business, around 31%, 25% they took from some large asset managers, and they've been slowly eating away this week. We know Northam owns a third of Royal Bafokeng Platinum now. What does the new Royal Bafokeng look like with Northam and Impala as large shareholders?
Well, it seems that, a couple of things. It seems that shareholders favor Impala's bid. I think the asset makes more sense for Impala. They're contiguous. They share the same facilities in some instances. So I think it makes, you know, there's more synergies to be had for Impala. So Impala can probably pay a higher price than Northam can. I'm not sure Northam's balance sheet can carry buying out the rest of RB Plats at the current or the higher price that they would need to pay. So it looks like Impala is in a better position here, but I think the fight's not clear cut. You know, if you're going to have two large shareholders, it's going to be difficult to make decisions. I think you'll want one significant controlling shareholder. And to get there, maybe Impala has to pay up even more, and I guess that is what the RB Plats share price is signaling, trading at above Impala's price of 150 Rand. It's signaling that maybe Impala will have to up the offer to get more shares on board to get control of the asset.
Pete, a little bit of a bizarre question, but topical with the holidays coming up. You, as a senior portfolio manager that's in charge of your own funds, when you're on holiday, how do you manage your risk with companies? What happens if there's a sign-off situation with a company within your portfolio and you're on the beach or in the bush or an event like COVID-19 where we saw equity markets drop 30% in the matter of a month?
Yeah, well, firstly, I mean, if there is a sudden deterioration in the environment or an air pocket, as one would call it, in share prices, there's nothing you can do in any case. I mean, you can't transact. The best defense against unexpected events is to have a well-diversified portfolio of assets which are priced generally at well below the intrinsic value, in other words, priced with a margin of safety. So, and then you can go away on holiday and not worry about it. I mean, a portfolio isn't something, at least the way I invest the funds I manage, I'm not trading every day. I'm not buying and selling stuff every day. I might put in trades once a month sort of thing. And then I just leave it alone because it is a well-diversified, robust portfolio as I like to call it, it's a bundle of twigs. We have a whole bunch of individual positions where each one on their own might turn out to be a standoff. You never know, a priori. But if you put those twigs together, and one breaks, but you've got that bundle together, it's still a very strong bundle. So no, I comfortably go away on holiday and I don't have to worry about the portfolio very much at all. In fact, and I think I've said this before, being away and leaving the portfolio alone is probably a better outcome for the portfolio than tinkering with it.
Pete, lastly, just beginning this week, we've had some of South Africa's top fund managers on the show giving their stock selection or their preferred stock selection for 2022. We're not going to be keeping tabs from a returns perspective. We understand if picking a single stock is similar to going to the casino. It's just more for educational purposes and we'll question you on them when there's certain corporate action or results of that company. Just to give you an idea, Corky Koyman, the banking guru, he chose Capitec. I had Peter Major on yesterday. He's obviously commodities focused. He didn't have a pick. He thinks that it's going to be a tough year for commodities in 2022. And just after this, I'm chatting to Chris Logan. I'm not too sure his pick is. Sorry, I didn't brief you on this beforehand, but just quickly give us your pick and then maybe just some of the reasons why.
Okay. So I'll give you two picks. So I'm going to hedge my bet somewhat. I'll give you two picks. I think the one pick is Sasol. I think the world is not investing in oil and gas extraction, enough to cope with a demand which will still be there for years and years to come despite the best efforts, and in a good way, the best efforts to go carbon neutral. I think the world will still need oil, and I think we can see, if not next year, the year after, significantly higher oil prices because of the underinvestment in oil extraction capacity. So that's the one pick. And the other pick is a very small cap business. It's quite a stinky one. It's not well liked by people, but that's why it's cheap. It's a property company, and I'm well known for not liking property, so I'm picking this on purpose. It's a company called Rebosis. It's A shares, had distributable earnings now and the results today of over R2 a share. They haven't distributed any dividends, but the earnings are there. And they say they've done a deal, where they sold the company for multiples of the current share price. So these shares earn R2.30, and they're trading R1.50. So, you know, there's a chance, a non-zero chance that this share is very cheap. There is also a non-zero chance that there's something funny going on that could turn into a spin-off. So I wouldn't put my grandmother's money into that one.
David Williams graced us with his presence earlier in the week where we were talking about the state of South Africa's rail structure. And David, I was quite surprised at the interest that was displayed by the BizNews community in that interview, given that there's been further developments in the last few hours. I thought it was appropriate for us to actually pick up on this, but it's almost like you've hit a raw nerve. The railway lines are there. We don't see trains on them. And suddenly someone explains to us what has happened and our eyes have been opened up by youth.
I've done more work on it since we last spoke, and it just gets worse when you look at the detail of it. I think the core issue here is security, and maybe that's an issue beyond rail. If you look at a country that is largely industrialized, certainly in the urban areas like South Africa, there's a lot of infrastructure. And to drive an economy like this, you need functioning organizations in rail, in electricity, in water, and so on. And we've had repeated allegations from Eskom recently about deliberate internal sabotage of infrastructure. And the railways, certainly, there may be sabotage, certainly the burning of trains in the Western Cape over the last few years, which we haven't really discussed. This is arson, criminal arson, and hundreds of train carriages at a cost of millions of rand have been burnt and destroyed in the Western Cape. That's arson stroke sabotage. And of course, the network itself is in such decay that very few trains are running. And just to restore this network back to something like what it looked before for passenger rail and for freight rail, but we're talking passenger rail agency at the moment, is going to cost hundreds of millions, possibly billions of rand. So the issue is security before you do anything else. How do you stop people stealing the railway lines? And it's become a kind of brigandage. There's no law and order when it comes to protecting the infrastructure. Reports have come through over the years of thieves taking the copper cables, the overhead wires, the signaling wires, digging up stations to get at cables under the ground. And of course, this happens to City Power in Johannesburg all the time as well. There appears to be no attempt or no strategy, certainly nothing's working, to stop these guys. They do it in broad daylight. There appears to be no arrests, let alone convictions.
Let's just imagine you're sitting in Cyril Ramaphosa's shoes. You see what's going on with the rail network. So you would want to get the right person in there to actually start at least arresting the decline. Now, he's done that with Transnet by bringing in Portia Derby. On South African Passenger Rail Services, or PRASA as it's called, it appeared that he did something similar with the appointment of Horsey Matthews earlier this year. But in the last few hours, Horsey Matthews has effectively been fired for having not disclosed that he, while he was in exile, had a British citizenship, and he's retained that British citizenship. And he, in other words, he's a dual citizen. What do you make of this, David? My suspicious mind is taking me down some very dark alleys.
Yeah, well, and he was on suspension, and they said this was the reason. And there were some hints at some other activity, goals not achieved. He hadn't achieved what he'd supposed to achieve. So there are a couple of issues here. One is the man comes in. He's been there 6 months or so. What one hears, he was trying to put things in place to start fixing things. Now he's been dismissed, apparently, for having not declared a dual citizenship on security grounds. And you have to ask, well, what is so top secret about passenger rail? And this is an industry where there's a lot of cooperation across the world. The technology is very common. Countries cooperate with each other on what kind of trains to run and on procurement and things like that. So it's a very strange reason. It's not like he's a general in the defense force. So what are these, what is the security issue? And surely you could find a way of saying, oh, you should have declared that. Well, we'll forgive you. We'll find a way around it. And as he has made clear, this was never a secret. He lived in exile in the UK. His father was Joe Matthews. He comes from a great struggle family. He lived in England for a long time. He had British citizenship. He's also a South African citizenship. There are a lot of people who have this status. Whether he wrote it down on a piece of paper or not, to me, seems immaterial. As you say, one's mind goes to what is the real reason for them doing this. They actually worked quite hard to get him in, and they understood, the board, that this was an appointment that badly needed to be made. They've had a dozen CEOs, most of them acting over the last 10, 12, 15 years. All of them have failed. Some of them have been before the Zondo Commission, and their questions about ethics and so on. So this was a really important appointment to make, especially given the damage that was done over the last 18 months in particular. A really important appointment. So you'd think they would do their homework, get the right man, and appoint him. Then when he was appointed, there were objections because he was too old. So he didn't meet the civil service requirements of being under 63 on appointment. And they rejected those objections. And they said, no, he's the right man for the job. We'll find a way. There is a way of appointing someone who's overage. And I'm sure there's a clause somewhere that says the minister has discretion if they want to. So they really tried hard to appoint him. They must have done homework. He's only been there 6 months. It's hard to imagine if he's made big mistakes, what they are in such a short time. I mean, in such a position, you spend the first few months finding out where everything is and who's running what and trying to get things going. So then you start saying, well, what is it? Is he uncovering corruption that certain interests don't want uncovered? Is he bumping up against vested interests? Is there a political dimension to this? Has he upset people in the government? Has he upset people among the partners of government? These are the kinds of questions we ask when we're told that he's been dismissed for having dual citizenship.
So what, going back to the fantasy of being in Cyril Ramaphosa's shoes, what should the president be doing about this, given that this is a national asset that has been massively destroyed, lots of corruption, as you mentioned earlier. There were former CEOs of Prazo who've appeared before the Zondo Commission. Let's go back into his shoes. He can't just wipe or Pontius Pilate like wipe his or wash his hands of this. Surely he has to get involved.
Well, in this case, particularly because it's this very strange anomaly when they split passenger rail from freight rail, it was a unified organization and it's now divided. Now, this has caused huge structural legacy issues. So, for example, in the old South African railways, Transnet in the early years, you had passenger trains and good trains all using the same network. Some lines dedicated to passengers only, like some of the suburban lines, the Mabopane corridor outside Pretoria, for example, the big link to Soweto. There's a four-line railway going to Soweto. These are dedicated passenger lines, but many areas, goods trains use them as well, and that worked perfectly well under the old Transnet South African Railways. For some reason, they felt that these two functions should be split. The result is you have, over the years, Prasa complaining that Transnet won't give them locomotives. Passenger trains no longer enjoy priority. In the old days, they always enjoyed priority. They were scheduled, and that had the effect of imposing a discipline on the entire network. Trains had to run on time in very scheduled spots, and if one train went wrong or broke down, then it would disrupt the whole network. Now, passenger trains have lost that priority on the joint lines. Transnet Freight Rail doesn't care about passengers, and why should it? That's not its brief. And there is a history, if you go through it, corruption takes the headlines, but there's a history of internal strife between the two railway managers. They bicker about locomotives. They bicker about who's going to fix what. There is land which Prasa owns, which Transnet used to own, and there's land that should be transferred that hasn't been transferred. And there's a lot of accounting issues to do with the split between these two organizations, which happened 20 years ago. And the accountants and the managers fight about who owes whom what, who's responsible for what, which trains run where, and who has priority. And this is all leaving out the theft and the corruption and inefficiencies in other ways. So the fundamental thing here, Alec, it's, you know, you and I have talked to interviewed people over many years on governance, and it sounds such a boring subject. In this case, it is a crucially important subject because the Prasa reports to the Minister of Transport and Transnet reports to the Minister of Public Enterprises. Now, the only way to get these two organizations together, it would seem, because they've not really got together yet, is to abolish that distinction and get Transnet to report to the Minister of Transport structurally. I'm not talking about personalities. We're talking about structure here. Now, you've got two ministers running different organizations. Their managers presumably have different incentives, different ways of doing things, which, as you say, leaves it up to only one man in the country to sort this out, and that's the president, because he's the only one who could say and get through a decision to say, right, let's combine these two portfolios and report to the Minister of Transport, who really is the person who should be responsible for Transnet. It's difficult enough running a business without such structural impediments. So you've got double structures that don't always talk to each other, are sometimes hostile towards each other, and in the circumstances of disaster, of corruption and theft. In military terms, it would be like having two allies who are actually fighting each other instead of fighting the enemy.
No one just buys a car. You may go to a dealership and consider all your options available in one place.
Maybe I'll get a family sedan and customize it just the way I want it. I'm looking for safety features like airbags for the family, of course.
So why should investing be any different? Glacier by Sanlam's investment platform offers you the widest choice of local and global funds from different fund managers that you can mix and match all in one place. And it lets you customize your investment exactly the way you want it. So you can enjoy your life exactly the way you want to. Ask your financial advisor why you're not with Glacier. Glacier Financial Solutions and Sanlam Life Insurance are licensed financial services providers.
I'm Jasra Roberts of BizNews, and with me is Corian Capital CIO, David Bacher. Corian Capital come out with an informative summary of asset class and fund performance return on a monthly basis that can be found on the BizNews website and on the Corian website. It's great for any level of investor. David, normally I ask you what caught your eye for the month, but I'm going to start with what caught my eye. The JSE All Share Index up 4.5% for the month of November, whilst the average South African equity fund was only up 1%. I know we've chatted about it in the past. I think we both have the same mindset when it comes to passive and active management. There is a place for both. But I, for one, am surprised in the stock pickers market in the last 2 years that the active managers are underperforming in the month of November by a staggering 3.5%. How was this possible?
You probably picked up on something that I've been, I think everyone's pondering at the moment, and it's a great question. But if I look back at the Corian report, which has been running for almost 5-6 years, I've never seen a dispersion between the peer group, the category average, and the All Share Index. And it looks alarming, but it isn't. And I'll tell you why. Because in South Africa, we have two different main indices. The man on the street and the public generally look at the All Share Index as the index has been around the longest. It's the most quoted. But the actual investment industry doesn't really track its performance against the All Share Index. And the question is why? And the reason is that the All Share Index is a much more concentrated, higher allocation to resource shares than most markets, and definitely relative to where investors would like to invest retirement fund money. So the actual industry standard, or the most asset managers in the industry, use what is called the CAPSWIX, which has two main differences in terms of its methodology. The one being that any underlying share is capped to 6% currently. And the other one is it only takes into account the shares that are registered in South Africa. So the actual makeup of the All Share Index relative to the CAPSWIX is night and day. And what will be interesting is the CAPSWIX return for November was just shy of 1%. So the actual active industry, you could say, did okay. And it's just what you're measuring the two indices, your performance against. And I just want to continue with this All Share Index. I mean, the All Share Index, its top five shares, and I'm double counting process in NASPAS because of the cross holding. Top five shares count 42% of that index. And the biggest allocation of the All Share Index is currently to Richemont. And Richemont, then Billiton, then Anglo's, and those shares really rallied hard during the last month as a result of a depreciating rand.
David, there's so much uncertainty at the moment. We've seen oil backtrack nearly 20% in November, the rand in free fall. We saw the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, come on stage and say that this whole transitory narrative that he's been trying to get across is no longer. Inflation is going to be persistent for longer, which is obviously not good for equity markets, not just in the US, but worldwide. What were the main economic factors that drove markets during November?
I think the majority of people are focused on this inflation number, and it has its impact on various asset classes. The fact that inflation in October in the US hit 6.2%, which is a three-decade high, is probably one of the reasons why the transitory speech has been sort of put to the back burner. So it's very much inflation as being the prominent concern. But you started this question by interluding that that oil has declined significantly. So has other commodities declined significantly. So maybe we are getting to the top end of the inflation concern. But the other main economic factor that everyone's talking about and which is top of mind of investors is the new COVID-19 variant and its implications and what that means for the market and different sectors in the industry. And I mean, I'm just talking personally, but the amount of friends and colleagues that I'm aware of that have caught COVID in the last three days has been staggering. But having said that, I haven't heard of many severe cases. So maybe this herd immunity with low severity could be a good thing. And we just don't know at the moment. So on the back of that uncertainty, you've seen a lot of volatility in asset classes, and that's best represented by the volatility index, the VIX, which has shot up during November.
David, I've been asking some of the regular fund managers that come onto BizNews this question, but I think you would be best placed to answer it. I was watching Bloomberg the other day. In the last 3 years, the S&P 500 has increased by around 30%. Okay, it's lagging 30%. It's a little bit this year, but it's on its way. There's only been one period in the last 50 years that the S&P 500 has 4 consecutive years of double-digit returns. How sustainable is this U.S. bull market?
It's front of mind from a Corian perspective. You know, we've been fortunate to have a very good product range in terms of our performance virtually across all our underlying offerings, except probably with our global allocation in equities. And it is for the reason you've mentioned. We are concerned that the S&P and the valuations are very high at the moment. And as a result, we have been underweight the best performing region stroke, I would say industry because of its tech heavy allocation. We don't think it's sustainable, given a number of reasons. Firstly, valuations. Secondly, it is driven by a lot of large cap companies, which we think, even if they do continue to do well, are going to face regulatory burdens and more obstacles going forward. But I also want to interject then, you know, one of the, you know, the man on the street sees the S&P or the Dow Jones or the NASDAQ reaching all-time highs. But, you know, given the weightings of those indices and given the emergence of passive shares and ETF shares and this wall of money that's been going into this, it's become almost like a virtuous circle. And if you look under those shares, the more broad sample of the market, I don't think it's reflective of economic prosperity and great earnings. And I came across an article on Bloomberg's yesterday where it showed that the number of shares in the U.S. market that are hitting its 52-week low relative to its 52-week high is at the same as it was at the height of COVID March 2020. And it's significantly indicating that this U.S. market is really driven by a few shares, large cap shares, but is not so representative of the broader market.
Dave, you're so right. I've been reading so much on it. Those large cap tech stocks are masking a lot of pain of what's going on underneath. But Dave, just wrapping up, we're coming to the end of 2021. How can you summarize this year from an investment perspective? And are you a little bit sheepish heading into 2022? A lot of the things that we've just chatted about in the last 10 minutes or so.
It's been a very good year for investors, and it's actually played out in terms of what you would expect the relative rankings would be of the various asset classes. So over time, you would expect property and equities to outperform bonds, which will outperform cash. And that's actually how it's played out this year. And if you look at what equities have done, you know, mid-20s, properties bounce back strongly, even higher than that. Those are good returns and very good returns for the man who's saving for retirement. It has been a bit of a lean period for South African investors over the preceding 5 years. But when it snaps back quickly, and those people who have stayed invested have been rewarded. So most retirement funds in South Africa, you know, will be close to, you know, 20% return when you have inflation, although picking up significantly at about 5-6%. That's a significant real return for people's long-term savings.
Well, thanks for being with us through this week. And even though Jared couldn't give us some happy news in the news headlines tonight, I'm pretty sure that this too shall pass. Better times will be across the hill, and we hope to be bringing you those on Monday. But tomorrow evening, we have on FMR Carrie's Corner with Carrie Adams. Don't miss it. And from the rest of the team, though, at BizNews, until the next time, cheerio. You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.